Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Tuesday, September 7th, and we are following a number of quickly developing stories this morning, including the United States now topping 40 million COVID cases since the start of the pandemic, with health experts keeping a close eye on the impact of Labor Day weekend travel. Plus, the Taliban claims to have captured the last part of Afghanistan, still holding out against their rule. It comes as Secretary of State Anthony Blinken visits Qatar, where he will hold meetings about the ongoing evacuation efforts. The very latest on the still growing death toll from last week's Hurricane Ida, as President Biden will visit New York and New Jersey today. And expanded unemployment benefits have expired for millions of Americans. What does it mean for the economic recovery? We'll look into that. But we begin this morning with a consequential week for Democrats as Congress returns to Washington this week. Democrats will begin the process of the most significant expansion of this country's social safety net in over half a century. The New York Times reports this morning that congressional committees are set to meet this week to devise legislation that would touch virtually every American's life from conception to age to infirmity. The paper reports the proposed legislation, a cradle-to-grave reweaving of a social safety net frayed by decades of expanding income inequality, stagnating wealth, and depleted governmental resources, capped by the worst public health crisis in a century. The pandemic loosened the reins on federal spending, prompting members of both parties to support showering the economy with aid. It also uncorked decades-old policy desires like expanding Medicare coverage or paid family and medical leave that Democrats contend have proved to be necessities as the country has lived through the coronavirus crisis. Democrats say they will finance their spending with proposed tax increases on corporations, which has already incited a multifaceted big budget effort by business groups working to kill the idea and by possibly taxing wealth in ways that the United States has never tried before. To critics, the legislation represents a fundamental upending of American-style governance and a shift towards social democracy. With it, they worry, would come European-style endemic unemployment and depressed economic dynamism. The Times notes that passage of the bill, which could spend as much as $3.5 trillion over the next decade, is anything but certain. But President Biden, who has staked much of his domestic legacy on the measure's enactment, will need every vote of every single Democrat in the Senate and virtually everyone in the House to secure it. Can he get that?
Yeah, and that's a question we should ask Jonathan Lemire. Let's bring in AP's White House correspondent, reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire. Also, the new executive editor and senior vice president for the Associated Press. And I think really most importantly, Jonathan Lemire's boss. Mm-hmm. Thank God there's one person keeping him like in line.
So this is the kind of Jonathan he needs. I need to show up at 6 a.m. Yeah.
Exactly. And I know he's so happy that you're here to see how he does. So, Jonathan, let's begin the audition in front of your boss. Jonathan Weissman of The New York Times laid it out very well this morning in describing just what's at stake. He said, as Meeker said also, cradle to grave reweaving of a social safety net frayed by decades of expanding income inequality. So much is on the line. You look at this and it really does. It's in line with the sweeping nature of FDR's New Deal and LBJ's Great Society. Here we have Joe Biden in reach of passing legislation that will easily be the most dramatic expansion of the social safety net since LBJ's Great Society. And all he needs are Democrats to vote for it. Here we are the day after Labor Day. There's been a lot of maneuvering this summer. What's it look like? Will the Democrats be able to stick together and make history? Again, let me underline this for people that may not have been following over the summer. Democrats don't need a single Republican vote to make this happen. Are they any closer to making history here?
Well, Joe, I'll start by noting with Julie's presence. This is the most nervous I've ever been on this TV show.
Yeah,
and I should take the moment to publicly congratulate Julie on the new her new job as executive editor at the AP. We could not be in better hands. So we're thrilled for that. As for your question, Joe, certainly this is a big moment for this president. This has always been, from the early days of administration, really embraced the comparisons to LBJ or to FDR, to go big. He has said, like, look, I'm a big government Democrat. I believe government can help people. And this is a moment, as the nation still battles this pandemic, that he and his advisors feel they can rewrite the role the government plays with citizens' lives, and particularly those who are less fortunate, to really help them get a hand up. But though this should be, you'd think, easy, quote, to get all Democrats in line, it's not going to be. The margins here are so small. It's just a handful of seats in the House. And of course, the Senate is that 50-50 tie, with Vice President Harris potentially acting as the tie-breaking vote. And we just heard from the other day that one of those moderate senators, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, suggesting that they push pause on the idea of that $3.5 trillion bill, the one just described there in the Times piece, because he has concerns about the economy being overheated, that government is playing too big of a role. Now, granted, he said that before Friday's disappointing jobs report, so that may cast a new light on what he thinks. But that is, it showcases the struggle the administration is going to have, where they have to satisfy moderates like Manchin and Sinema, who are concerned about the size of a potential package like that, but also progressives, particularly those in the House, who want to go even bigger. But at the end of the day, can any of those Democrats really be the vote that defeats the signature proposal, the signature agenda of a Democratic president? That's a tall order. But for some senators, that will be the question they have to make. They have to ask themselves, do they cast their vote to pass this, but potentially risk taking heat from more conservative voters back home? Can a Manchin sell this in West Virginia? Can Tester sell it in Montana? Whatever that state may be, it's going to be very difficult thin line for this president to walk.
You know, Julie, I wonder sometimes if we, not talking about you, of course, I'll just take all the blame for this myself. I wonder sometimes if we in the media don't pay close enough attention to how big this bill is, how sweeping this bill is, how historic this bill is. Mm-hmm. I know there's coverage, but there's not been a lot of really in-depth reporting and debating and fighting and back and forth, at least on this show, about what's at stake here. It is historic. I remember hearing Biden's speech back in April and was shocked by how sweeping it was for this supposed moderate guy from Delaware. But again, this will reverse 40 years of Reaganism, just like Ronald Reagan reversed 45 years of Roosevelt's New Deal. I'm wondering if we're going to get more into that as we move forward, and there's going to be more heated debate going into the fall because of just the sheer size and scope of this, and how this will fundamentally change Americans' relationship with the government.
I do think it's really important for us to keep casting this legislation in that light. There's been a lot of focus, obviously, on the top line number. There's been a lot of focus on this very narrow tightrope that Biden has to walk to get this legislation passed. But what we are essentially talking about here is a fundamental shift in the social safety net in this country. And as you say, reversing decades where the government under Republican leadership in most cases has been weakening that social safety net. And what Biden is trying to do is a reversal that would not just last throughout his presidency, but would extend well beyond. And that's why I do think as we look to the politics and we look to the votes, this is going to be very tricky for some Democrats to vote against, even if they are nervous about that price tag, or they are the Democrats who want that price tag to be even bigger. There are so many Democratic priorities, so many things that Democrats have wanted for so long with regards to childcare, to helping working families that are in this bill, to defeat it because it doesn't meet all of your needs seems hard to envision. Though I will say, every Democratic lawmaker right now, we talked a lot about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema earlier this year. Every Democratic lawmaker is in that position right now. Any single one of them could derail this bill. That gives them a lot of power as well to tweak this around the edges.
Yeah, you know, Mika, we've heard an awful lot about a 50-50 nation, Republicans and Democrats fighting back and forth, gridlock in Washington, D.C., the death of bipartisanship. Well, the Democrats have actually found themselves set up in a position now again where even though it is a 50-50 split in the United States Senate and the margins are so small in the House, somehow they have found themselves in a position as we move into the fall where their fate is in their own hands.
Right.
And it really is astounding that there are some people in the Democratic Party that are even suggesting this deal's not going to get done. They're going to have to get a deal done. They're going to have to figure out how to come together as a Democratic caucus in the Senate and in the House and pass this legislation. Maybe it's not $3.5 trillion. Maybe Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema find a compromise with progressives, but that compromise has to be found. They have no other choice. They have to make history, or, of course, there will be no justification for them to run for re-election.
So some of the other big stories we're following this morning, the death toll continues to climb in the Northeast following the devastation by the remnants of Hurricane Ida. President Biden will visit New York and New Jersey today after approving major disaster declarations in both states, green-lighting more federal aid. Meanwhile, across Louisiana and Mississippi, hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses are still without power. NBC's Von Hilliard will give us the latest from the Gulf Coast in just a moment. But first, here's NBC News correspondent Gabe Gutierrez with more on the Northeast aftermath.
As Ida's torrential rain pounded New York City, officers frantically tried to reach this flooded basement. But when specialized rescue teams got there, it was too late. Three people had already drowned.
This storm has now rewritten the map. We used to think flooding was a coastal thing. It's not anymore.
In a city where affordable housing is hard to come by, the storm's aftermath is raising new questions about whether the Northeast is prepared for climate change and whether local officials gave enough warning.
The water got all the way
all
up here.
All the way up to the window.
And in another building in Queens, Danette Rivera was also trapped inside her basement.
Did you ever expect this much water?
Never. Absolutely not.
Look at this. It's a disaster.
This is what it looked like outside.
So the water was gushing in.
We were locked in to the basement. There was no way out.
Her son, who was blind, managed to reach through this window and pull her to safety.
When it started to go above my head, I thought I was gonna die.
In New York City, 13 people died. In New Jersey, at least 27. Four are still missing, including two college students who witnesses say were swept away by rushing water.
Please pray for them. Pray for them, please. Everybody pray for them.
President Biden now set to tour Manville, New Jersey. Home after home, basement after basement, flooded out. Insurance adjusters are expected here over the coming days, but the agonizing cleanup is only just beginning.
A lot of memories here.
Yes, absolutely.
Karen Payer survived the storm in her home, caring for her elderly mother, a quadriplegic who couldn't easily be evacuated by boat.
I look around, and I don't know where to start. You know, I don't know.
Half a million in Louisiana are still without power. Some communities surrounded by standing water, homes gone.
There's not a person on this bayou that's not suffering.
Katie Arias' home overtaken by floodwaters, furniture tossed to the mud.
You're drowning and you're reaching up and saying, help me, and no one's coming.
Officials say the total number of destroyed power poles higher than Hurricanes Katrina, Ike, Delta, and Zeta combined. The National Guard now operating a floating bridge to one town completely cut off by floodwaters.
These waters and mud with nowhere to go.
The mud just keeps coming and coming and coming, you know.
Concerns also rising about the most vulnerable.
No light, no water, no hot water, no hot meals or nothing.
Over the weekend, 600 residents evacuated from 8 senior centers after the health department deemed them unfit for ongoing occupancy.
Nobody showed up. Nobody, not one person showed up to come check on us.
The city says 5 are dead.
What we found was unacceptable.
Meanwhile, 7 now dead, and the state attorney general demanding answers after more than 800 nursing home residents were evacuated to this warehouse and left on cots in floodwaters.
People shouldn't be treated like that. You should be held accountable.
But also small miracles. Chained up and trapped under debris, animal rescuers found this pup, Bubbles, who survived for 4 days. Like many here, looking for a new home. Vaughn Hilliard, NBC News, Lafitte, Louisiana.
Boy, I tell you what, it is so discouraging. You see one weather disaster after another. It's and if obvious. You want to have a debate, Mika, with two sides on climate change, whether climate change is causing all of this damage, don't invite insurance adjusters on the show, because they will tell you that the claims have exploded over the past 20 years, that climate change is undeniable. It's bad, and it keeps getting worse. There's a Washington Post study that came out over the past week that shows that this summer, 1 in 3 Americans, people living in 1 in 3 counties in America, have been hit by a climate disaster this year. Heat wave. 64% of the counties in this country have been hit by heat waves as well. The weather situation is bad, and it goes from bad to worse. As Democrats are looking at that $3.5 trillion bill, obviously I know that they're focusing on climate change, but we're going to have to figure out a way not only to continue taking care of it in this country, but also we're going worldwide. To have to get serious with China, with India, with other countries who are the main polluters on the planet and have got to figure out a way to bring the world to the table.
For sure. We're going to move to Afghanistan now. The Taliban claims to have taken control of the Panjshir province, the last area in Afghanistan held by resistance forces. Witnesses from the area who spoke on the condition of anonymity tell the Associated Press that thousands of Taliban fighters charged into 8 districts of the region overnight. But representatives for the resistance forces say the Taliban's claim of victory is false, insisting they will continue to fight from strategic positions across the area. Meanwhile, 4 more Americans were evacuated from Afghanistan yesterday. A State Department official said the Americans were safely removed overland, and the Taliban, quote, was aware and did not impede their transit. This was the first known case of U.S. citizens being evacuated since the troop withdrawal officially ended last week. The White House has says it will continue to work to evacuate all Americans who wish to leave Afghanistan. The president estimated last week 1 to 200 U.S. citizens still remain. Joining us now, NBC News foreign correspondent Raf Sanchez from Doha, Qatar. Raf, what can you tell us?
Mika, good morning. For days now, the State Department has been pretty vague about what's going on with charter planes being stopped from leaving Mazar-e-Sharif Airport in the north of Afghanistan. This morning here in Doha, Secretary of State Blinken finally giving some details on that situation. He confirms there was what he said was a relatively small number of Americans who were trying to get on those planes and get out of the country. But the problem, he said, was those Americans and other Afghans with valid travel documents are mixed in with Afghan citizens who do not have the right paperwork. And so right now, the Taliban is not allowing any of those people to leave. The secretary also denying a claim made over the weekend by Representative Mike McCaul, a Republican, that this was a hostage situation at Mazar-e-Sharif Airport. Take a listen to what the secretary had to say.
There are groups of people who are grouped together, some of whom have the appropriate travel documents, an American passport, a green card, a visa, and others do not. And it's my understanding that the Taliban has not denied exit to anyone holding a valid document, but they have said that those without valid documents at this point can't leave. But because all of these people are grouped together, that's meant that flights have not been been allowed to go. We've been able to identify a relatively small number of Americans who we believe are seeking to depart from Mazar-e-Sharif with their families. We have been assured, again, that all American citizens and Afghan citizens with valid travel documents will be allowed to leave. It's my understanding that the Taliban has not denied exit to anyone holding a valid document. We are not aware of anyone being held on an aircraft or any hostage-like situation in Mazar-e-Sharif. So we have to work through the different requirements, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Now, guys, the details here are still pretty vague, but this is what many were concerned about, that when U.S. troops left Afghanistan, the American citizens left behind would effectively be at the mercy of the Taliban as to whether they can leave the country. And now that the Taliban is the government, they can hide behind bureaucratic procedures. They can say, look, we're not stopping anybody from leaving. All they need to do is have the right paperwork. The secretary did say the United States is engaging with the Taliban on this issue at Mazar-e-Sharif, including in the last couple of hours. Now, also this morning, we are seeing what appears to be the largest protests yet in Kabul since the city fell to the Taliban back on August 15th. We're seeing very large groups of both men and women on the streets together protesting against the Taliban. Taliban gunmen have been firing in the air trying to disperse those crowds. There are no reports yet of any injuries. Guys?
NBC's Raf Sanchez, thank you very much. And can you imagine the bravery of the women protesting, Joe?
It really is. It's remarkable, and it continues to be an unfolding story that Jonathan Lemire, obviously the White House is very concerned about and are taking a position with the Taliban, not trust but verify, but pressure and then verify. Obviously, if you hear conservative commentators, read conservative op-eds, listen to conservative members of Congress, Republicans in Congress, they'll attack Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken for trusting the Taliban. But it's not just them that are applying pressure. You've obviously got dozens of countries across the globe applying that pressure, and the leverage that they seem to be holding over the Taliban is the financial future of that country. Whether that country and whether the Taliban's government is able to survive or not financially, and obviously that's going to be attached. Their credit's going to be attached. Money coming to that country's going to be attached to how they act over the next several months.
Yeah, we've heard a few threats from the White House as to what they will do if the Taliban doesn't cooperate. One is the idea of international recognition. We heard from the president over the weekend saying that they certainly weren't at the time yet to formally recognize the Taliban as the government there in Afghanistan. And I think there's some question as to how much the Taliban cares about that. But they certainly do care about the ability to have pay for their government. As you said, the finances of the nation are certainly at risk here, and pressure being applied certainly from the U.S., but other countries too. And we are seeing some real, the U.S. is really starting to lean on the Taliban here. We heard from the president the other day estimate that about 100 to 200 Americans are still in Afghanistan. Some are getting out, but it's a very slow process. As just described in that report, a lot of bureaucratic paperwork being cited as the reason for the delays. And certainly, the U.S. has said, no, we don't trust the Taliban. We're going to be very clear about that. We don't trust them, but we have no choice but to work with them. The Secretary of State is in the region. There's back-channel talks beyond his public comments there. They're looking to get this and get it done as quickly as possible, but it's going to be some time. Of course, for the Americans, that's a priority, but also for our Afghan allies, who for 20 years worked alongside the U.S. military.
Yeah, and Julie, when I talk to whether it's reporters or whether it's people in the administration, whether it's former members of the CIA who spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, they all tell me that designation of, quote, American is a very complicated one. People with dual citizenships who have been trying to decide whether to leave their families or go, whether they could bring their families or not. I'll just say some people, former members of the agency, suggest that some people stayed in Afghanistan, profiteering off of the war and other things, and wanting to be on the last flight out, and listed a number of reasons. So, you know, it really is not as cut and dry, I think, as some make it out to be. It's been complicated. And as the White House has said, they've given well over a dozen warnings since April that the situation was deteriorating, and Americans, if they wanted to go home, needed to get out.
I think complicated is a good way to put it when we're getting down to this last group of people. This is not as simple as saying, you're an American, do you want to get out? And people saying, yes, put me on a plane. The people who were in those situations largely have already left the country. So you are now dealing with people who, in some cases, are not completely sure that they want to leave, may have reasons to stay that are family related, may have business reasons why they want to stay. There are some of these Americans who have been in this country for a very long time. So this is not as simple of a question as it was earlier, I think, at this summer. I do think, though, you know, the broader challenge for the Biden administration right now is how long can you work with the Taliban in a place where the Taliban is willing to be something of a partner? You know, the Taliban is helping facilitate some of these exits right now. But the Taliban has this international question about recognition and also this question about how they govern. And as these protests perhaps build in Kabul, I think that's what the administration is worried about as well, is how the Taliban could react there and then how that impacts the Taliban's willingness to continue to work with the Americans and other international nations to facilitate these final exits.
And there's no doubt there are going to be protests in Afghanistan, even at the height of the war when the Taliban was moving. I remember seeing a poll something like 5, 6, 7 years ago that the Taliban's approval rating in Afghanistan was like 18%, 19%, 20%. The Taliban has never been seen as some heroic force, some liberating force by all the people of Afghanistan. So chances are good that civil war is going to continue as it's has been going on for 20 years or so. So it's very good to be back. As we go to break, I just want to say really good to be back. And there are a few things that I've wanted to say over the last week or so. And so my guess is that a lot of you are going to probably disagree with what I have to say, because I just haven't heard it much coming out of the halls of Congress or from other TV news shows. But here it goes. I'm really proud of what I've seen from my country, from America, over the past few weeks. And again, I know that sounds disconcerting, because over the past several weeks, when I've been to, whether it's been at dinner or whether I've met people in the neighborhood, wherever I see people, they're just talking about how bad things are going in this country. But I don't see it that way. You know, I am positive, and I'm positive even though I thought, unlike about 75% of Americans, I thought we should have kept some troops in Afghanistan. But what I've seen this past month has highlighted both the greatness and the goodness of America and Americans. First, let's talk about the greatness. Think about this now. And again, we aren't saying this enough. The United States of America did something no other country ever could do or ever would do. We airlifted 120,000 frightened souls out of Afghanistan, and Americans saved their lives. As David Sanger at the New York Times noted, that's about the population of Billings, Montana. And it was a feat every bit as awe-inspiring as the Berlin airlift. And you can bet it will be remembered for years as a monumental achievement in humanitarian aid. U.S. troops put their lives on the line, and 13 heroes paid the ultimate sacrifice for the tens of thousands of lives that they saved. One of those liberators was Marine Sergeant Nicole G., who cradled an Afghan baby in her arms and wrote on her Instagram page, "I love my job." And of course she did. You see, duty, honor, and courage are not just words from an old speech. It was the creed that they lived by every day. So too did the C-17 pilot who, as David Ignatius recounted in the Washington Post, roared down at Kabul runway in a plane that was overloaded with 823 desperate Afghan evacuees, double its capacity. And as they were rumbling down that runway, and a nervous co-pilot asked if the packed plane could lift off in that intense heat, the pilot answered, "Just watch me." It's a moment that took me back to the beginning of our war on terror, when Todd Beamer whispered the words, "Let's roll," on Flight 93 before it was taken down in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And as Carlos Lozada wrote in the Washington Post this week, the passengers of that ill-fated flight quietly voted in the back of the plane whether to rush the cockpit and take their own plane down to protect other Americans on the ground. As Lozada movingly writes, they voted on it. They voted. Even in that moment of unfathomable fear and distress, the passengers took a moment to engage in the great American tradition of popular consultation before deciding to become this war's earliest soldiers. Lozada asks at the end, was there ever any doubt as to the outcome of that ballot? Well, of course there wasn't, as you know. And as stories of the goodness of Americans who are now coming together from the left, from the right, progressives, evangelicals, coming together to welcome these Afghan refugees to our shores, I have no doubt that despite all of our failings and our flaws, we as a nation will continue stumbling toward the light. Just watch us. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Morning Joe. 35 past the hour, the White House announced the president's schedule for the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. President Biden and the First Lady will travel to all three sites of the terror attacks on Saturday, visiting Ground Zero in New York City, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and the Pentagon. Vice President Harris and the second gentleman will also visit Shanksville, Pennsylvania, for a different memorial and will join the first family at the Pentagon. And in the 20 years, if you can believe it, 20 years since the 9/11 attacks on the nation, terrorists have evolved their tactics. But so has law enforcement. Tom Winter covers the New York Police Department for NBC News and has this exclusive look at how the NYPD works every day to make sure the city is never ground zero again.
When it comes to terrorism, New York City's police department isn't afraid to publicly show force. But in the shadows, in places they don't allow cameras, the brains of the department work 24/7.
So I would imagine after these events that we're probably going to see a pickup.
This is the NYPD's Intelligence Bureau.
We decided that if we really want to do this right, we have to have a dedicated force that is specially trained.
The man in charge, a 37-year veteran NYPD cop from the beat, Chief Thomas Galati, determined to try to stop the next terror attack, building on the lessons from the past.
I think if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, the failure was the failure of sharing of intelligence. So, you know, you don't want to be the person that's holding a piece of information and then something happens.
We were there the morning after a bomb ripped through a crowd in Kabul, Afghanistan. NBC News granted exclusive access to the day's intelligence briefing.
Morning, Chief. Morning, Commissioner. This is going to provide a situational update based on our initial assessment of the attack.
The NYPD's focus? Making sure no suspected terrorists are sneaking into the flood of Afghan evacuees.
A large majority being in Paris area. They're being vetted by the DGSI, which is our equivalent of the FBI.
Right away, Galati spots a potential problem.
There's been some reporting from the UK that some of the people there were actually no-flied.
Yeah, or on some other kind of watch list.
The lesson of 9/11, Galati says, identify the threat overseas before it comes home to New York City. How? 15 NYPD posts across the globe.
So essentially, the sun never sets on an NYPD detective.
No.
A network of cops and analysts that went to work right after Ariana Grande's concert was attacked in 2017 in Manchester, England.
We went immediately and looked at, okay, where do we have concerts right now?
Assistant Commissioner Rebecca Weiner, based at a secret location in Lower Manhattan, says there's more plots than ever.
So there's been 51 plots and attacks against the city in the last 20 years. Half of those, 25, have been in the last 5 years.
A rising number originating at home.
We've seen not just a transition from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, which we saw in 2014 really sharply, but other actors like racially, ethnically motivated violent extremists, white supremacists, neo-Nazi, what we call accelerationists, and then anti-government extremism.
Keeping the country safe from any threat is a personal mission for Gulati. Ground Zero is just a half mile from his office. Names on the wall, people he knew.
What is the thing that keeps you up at night on the dawn of this anniversary?
Well, I think that, you know, I never feel easy, even if I do think that we have a good handle on the threat stream. It's the unknown that really frightens me.
Let's bring in right now NBC News Investigations reporter Tom Winters. He joins us now. Hey, Tom, you know, for those outside of New York City, even I guess for a lot of people inside of New York, the size and the scope of their anti-terror efforts really would be shocking. I remember when I first learned of just how big it was. I was really surprised. Talk about that. Talk about the focus since 9/11 and how they continue to succeed.
Well, I think an important thing to note, you know, you mentioned outside of New York City, people may not understand, although a lot of people outside of New York City have benefited from the work of the women and men that we showed you in that piece right there. I talked to, and I don't have to take the NYPD's word for it, I talked to law enforcement agencies all up and down the East Coast. My colleague Andrew Blankstein speaks to them on the West Coast. It's very clear. The NYPD's programs and their Operation Sentry, which is designed to share law enforcement information from police departments to New York and then spread out throughout the country, or from New York spread out throughout the country, has been enormously successful. I know police departments rely on their information from their briefs, from what they're getting from overseas, those outposts as part of the NYPD's foreign liaison program that I mentioned. And on top of the analytical work, you know, they've stood up a new unit. It's called REMI, the racially and ethnically motivated extremist group. So they're focused now not just on what's going on in Afghanistan, not just what Al-Qaeda or ISIS may be saying, but they're really focusing on the domestic terrorism threat. People that want to commit horrible, violent acts in the name of, say, white supremacists, white supremacy, or perhaps in the name of a far-right terrorism, anti-government terrorism. So they're keenly focused on those new threats. As you heard in the piece, Joe, obviously those threats are increasing. So they're focused on pushing that information out as well as taking it in.
Well, and of course, Tom, I remember after 9/11, the terrible days and weeks and months after 9/11, the silver lining was just how united this country was. It was extraordinary. I'd never really seen anything like it in my life before. If you weren't there, it'd be hard to describe somebody younger who's used to seeing this country divided, how united we were after 9/11. Which really makes your last point so difficult to grasp, that here we are 20 years later and the NYPD's biggest threat may not be coming from overseas after all. It may be coming from domestic terrorists, of course, that lone wolf that we've been hearing about for quite some time. How are they having to adjust their thinking? How are they having to adjust their tactics?
You know, when I speak to people in law enforcement that specialize in this area, we look at the internet really as this gigantic jukebox in some ways of hate. So whether you are interested in some sort of a Islamic extremist, the message of ISIS, whether you're interested in a message of white supremacy, whether there's some sort of a anti-government or far right, we saw it with the Nashville bombing where you had a possible motive there, believing that people, that there's a section of government that are actually lizards. I'm not making that up. You look at all the different types of things that are out there on the internet, and people just kind of pick the tune that they want to listen to if they want to act out and commit violent acts. One of the things that they're doing, they're taking to social media, being careful, obviously, to understand that people have First Amendment rights to say things, but it's trying to be on top of the threat when those social media posts, when their comments to their neighbors, to their friends, to their loved ones, take a turn from political statements or from statements on whatever viewpoints they may have towards a direction of violence. And that's really where their big challenge is. That's where their civilian analysts and that's where their detectives are keenly focused on. And obviously, as you saw from the piece, not just here in the U.S., but from abroad as well.
NBC's Tom Winter, thank you very much for that reporting. And coming up, the new abortion law in Texas is facing a potential challenge from the Justice Department. We'll have the latest on that legal fight and what the rideshare companies Lyft and Uber are doing to help drivers who might get sued under the bounty measure of the controversial law.
The bounty measure of a vigilante law was passed to actually avoid the enforcement of a constitutional right that's been in this country for 50 years.
We're going to explore that big
vigilantes.
Time.
Yeah.
Plus, expanded unemployment benefits meant to ease the economic shock of the coronavirus pandemic have come to an end. What it means for millions of Americans who are still without a job. Morning Joe is coming right back.
Hey, welcome back to Morning Joe. What a beautiful sunrise over Washington, D.C. on this morning after Labor Day.
Beautiful.
Just gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
More news now. Expanded unemployment benefits for more than 7.5 million Americans expired yesterday. The question is, what will the impact of that be on the economic recovery? NBC senior business correspondent Stephanie Ruhl reports on that.
Unemployment benefits are over for 7.5 million Americans. Another 3 million will see their weekly checks cut by $300. It comes as hiring slowed in August, likely due to the surge of the Delta variant. Brooke Whitford delivered groceries when the pandemic started. She scaled back her hours over COVID concerns and a drop in wages. She's been on unemployment since April of last year.
Knowing that this date was coming up, what's that been like for you?
Stressful. That's the one word I can say. Stressful. Put me in kind of a slump, kind of a depression.
Whitford says she's applied for over 150 jobs in the last few months, but so far, no offers.
I don't meet the criteria or they've already hired somebody.
For every 8 people who lost their unemployment benefits in June, only 1 found a new job. Reasons include the lack of childcare and the growing mismatch between the jobs available and people looking for work.
We've never cut off benefits for this many people all in one fell swoop. Unemployment comes fast, but finding a job can often take a lot of time.
But with a record 10 million jobs now available, many business owners like Joseph Termini hope the end of benefits helps them find much needed workers. The bakery owner has already begun to see more applicants.
I wouldn't call it a flood. I would say it was more of a trickle. But yes, we did see an uptick in people that were interested.
So, Julia Pace, interesting piece by Stephanie Ruhl there with a lot of different realities. Can you connect the dots for us? Because how does the desperate search for jobs on one hand for those whose benefits have run out match up with this labor shortage that we're witnessing and supply shortage that we're witnessing?
There are so many competing factors, I think, at play here. You know, from a purely economic standpoint right now, you know, we're in a labor shortage. You talk to business owners across this country and they say they simply cannot find people to work. But there are a lot of reasons why people are not returning to work. And I think that part of that is because of this resurgent Delta variant. You know, we're in a situation right now where a lot of people are sending their kids back to school. A lot of uncertainty about what that school year is going to look like, which means a lot of uncertainty around childcare, which then makes it harder to commit to to a job. So I think that, you know, we're going to see over the next couple of months, I think we have to let this play out a bit before we see what the impact of cutting off these unemployment benefits is. At this point, very little appetite in Congress to extend those benefits, but it's a really uncertain fall, I think, ahead for this country, both on an economic and a pandemic perspective.
That's well said. Very uncertain fall. Jonathan Lemire, could we actually increase the level of unemployment in the Red Sox bullpen as we move into the fall? Maybe just get rid of all of them, send them to Springfield.
There are certainly a number of them who should lose their jobs and certainly wouldn't get any benefits if the members of Red Sox Nation would be asked their opinions. Joe, this has been a season that for most part has exceeded expectations. But man, we have had our share of gut punch losses. And I'd say yesterday might be the worst yet. A 7-1 lead with Chris Sale on the mound, shoddy defense all over the place, a ball lost in the sun, blown lead after blown lead, and a bullpen meltdown that would require all these relievers to go to Springfield, which is particularly tricky since, of course, the Red Sox don't actually have a minor league team in Springfield, which makes it that much more of a punishing sentence, I suppose.
Well, thank you for explaining that to the non-Red Sox fans. They all need to go straight to Springfield, Mika. You know, Mika, our Labor Day. Mika, our Labor Day was held up a little bit yesterday,
was it not?
By me watching television and gently whispering at the TV screen, "Oh, come on, fellas. Is that how it went?"
No, the house almost fell down with your loud bellowing.
I was not happy.
It was not good.
There may have been a little bit of bellowing.
A little childish.
Was not childish.
Julie Pace, thank you very much for being on this morning.
And thank you, Julie, and congratulations again. My gosh, we're so happy for you.
Yay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Still ahead. How mob justice is trampling democratic discourse. Anne Applebaum's latest piece is entitled "The New Puritans." And she joins us just ahead on Morning Joe. Plus, the man who ran Washington when Washington ran the world. We'll revisit the life and legacy of James Baker in light of the fall of Afghanistan. We'll be right back.